Chapter 3. Shirt back on now. Okay, Alan, you can pop your shirt back on now. I'm with my GP, Dr. Tony Bracegirdle, or Doc as he's known to our pub quiz team, Cromwell's Bitches. He's a good friend and I've asked him to give me a full medical check-up to ensure that it's safe to walk 160 miles in the footsteps of my father. What's the verdict, Doc? I say to Doc. He makes a few notes, in handwriting atypical of a GP. Most write in lightning-fast but illegible scrawl. Doc, as befits a man who once spent 10 hours in a John Lewis choosing a sound bar for his TV, writes slowly and clearly and deliberately, all the while exhaling from his nose loudly. You should try being on a pub quiz team with him when you're meant to be handing your answer sheets in. Eventually he stops writing and turns to face me. Alan? He stops and takes off his glasses to give his eyes a rub and enjoy a long, long nasal exhalation. Yes, Doc? The thing is, Alan... He closes his eyes to consider how to word his answer, and, yeah, why not enjoy another nasal exhalation? I stare at him impatiently. We're going to be late for the first round, brackets TV theme tunes, and that's where the bitches pick up most of our points. Another nasal exhalation. I feel like sliding a harmonica on the desk in front of him to see if he plays it remotely with his nose. Yes, Doc, spit it out. You're not a fit man, Alan. Your levels of physical fitness aren't what they should be. If you attempt this walk in your current physical condition, well, it's my medical opinion that, another nasal exhalation, you could seriously harm yourself. The news hits me like a clap of thunder. I always thought I was in reasonable shape. A retired headmistress I once briefly dated said that I had the BMI and muscle definition of a man 5/6 of my age. I'd stood up in my underpants to show off the results of a sizzling summer abs workout I'd read in the Daily Mail's Female magazine. And while my abdomen wasn't anything like a six-pack, I enjoyed being able to slap my belly without it making a loud clap. Standing there in the flickering light of a portable TV, letting the former educator look at my body and finish a cigarette, I pledged to remember how good it felt to be fit and strong, and promised myself I would develop a workout that would keep me in good shape forever, and which I could pass on to others. Footnote. I never got round to developing that workout. I got distracted trying to get a tow bar fitted to my car for under £150 and forgot all about the day in Celine's bedroom. If you do want to get in shape, though, try to find old copies of Female magazine because the sizzling summer abs workout was in there. It would have been around April or May 2011. I think it was Female, anyway. The gist of it was, do lots of sit-ups. But here I am, being told by Docky Bracegirdle that I'm a physical wreck. I need to do something, and fast. After all, I wasn't going to pull off a walk of this magnitude without first getting myself into quite superb physical condition, or QSPC, my acronym. I'd originally achieved QSPC as a teenager in the mid-1970s when I became one of the first children in Norfolk to take up an exciting avant-garde art form called Irish dancing. It's a dance of two distinct requirements, in which one's legs must move as quickly and violently as possible, while one's arms and torso act as if they have no idea this is going on. And whether jigging with fellow dancers or practicing alone in the abandoned quarry near my house, the pastime did wonders for my cardiovascular fitness. In short, it made my lungs absolutely massive, and being a big-lunged boy had all sorts of unexpected benefits. For example, holding my breath became an absolute pleasure, and I'd often wow the girls by walking the entire way to school in just 4 gulps of air. But it was when it came to whistling that QSPC was the real game-changer. Don't forget this was a time when whistling mattered. Far from simply being the pastime of choice for granddads and postmen, in the 1970s everybody whistled, even women. Whistling dominated the mainstream, but it also played an important role in our subculture. With a thriving underground scene, located primarily in my school, it's no exaggeration to say that whistling was the rap music of its day. With my newfound pulmonary punching power, I could hold a note as long as your arm, if that's the phrase, and boy or girl did I make it count. Many was the time I'd reduce the playground to a reverential hush as I stood atop the climbing frame, head tossed back, hands miming a bugle, and whistled the entirety of the last post in a single breath. It was a stunning achievement. While I always appreciated the way my school colleagues would turn and stare, and was always flattered by the celebratory hail of stones that would rain down on me at the end of the rendition, I could tell that they didn't recognise the tune, and that troubled me. How could these children not even be on nodding terms with the basic musical staples of a military funeral? And it's not as if they were toddlers. These people were nearly 9 years old. What exactly were their parents teaching them at home? The mind boggles. Although this sorry tale may provide a clue as to why so many of my former classmates are now on zero-hour contracts. Fast forward to the present day. Got there yet? And one thing I don't have is the luxury of time. Having spoken to my doctor, it isn't hard to read between the lines. Get into QSPC in the next 2 weeks or the walk to Dungeness will surely, surely kill me. But is such a transformation even possible? Well, other than the fat back that's dogged me since the age of 40, I have a surprisingly toned body, well-proportioned and naturally hairless. It's a physique that's still able to draw admiring glances to this day, whether on a tropical beach or in the leisure centre showers. Of course, none of us are completely immune from the ravages of ageing. I'm not so ashamed to admit that since 2010, my buttocks have become increasingly slack and gelatinous. Look at a photograph of my backside these days, and it would bring to mind images of a cold bowl of porridge with a skin on the top. And I'm fine with that, not least because these photographs, taken at the start of each financial year, are purely for my own records. The point I'm trying to make is this. While I may not be a meathead like Ben Fogle or Dan Snow, I do keep myself in pretty decent nick and see no need to spend my training time, as I know Dan does, trying to develop pecs as big as tits. No, my own training will focus on stamina, not strength. Footnote. I'm reliably informed that Snow and Fogle, or Snogle, are only a constant presence in the BBC gym, and that no one gets into the free weights area without their say-so. You can try if you want, but the last presenter to do so got chased into the showers and savagely towel-whipped. Jeremy resigned from Newsnight the following day, his job prospects, not to mention his amateur clean-and-jerk career, in tatters. In their tight lycra shorts and matching white leather weightlifter's gloves, the powerfully nosed twosome push themselves to the limits. While one lifts, the other spots his partner in Latin, tempta vehementius. The spotter will bellow, iterum. And as he pats his partner's muscles, he'll congratulate him on his work. Bene fecisti, bene fecisti. But Snogle's true ire is reserved for those BBC presenters using the cardiovascular equipment. Nick Witchell, whose way of using the cross-trainer is admittedly very gay, gets more grief than most. Not that he minds. You can't be a royal correspondent who knows for a fact that the royals hate you without having a pretty thick hide. Distance runners tend to train at high altitude. The thinner air is harder to breathe, which irritates them, thus making them train harder. Many opt to base themselves in the highlands of Kenya, where, as well as some colossal altitudes, they're guaranteed a warm welcome from the Kenyish people. For athletes enjoying a day off, there's also the chance to head out on safari, where, with a fair wind and an experienced guide, they might just come across the unforgettable sight of a rhino before it gets shot in the head by an American tourist. I myself would never shoot big game and would hesitate to even lay traps for them. You see, as a committed animal liker, hashtag animals, I think very carefully about which animals I am and am not prepared to kill. So, as I say, something like a lion or an elephant is off the agenda, and my reason for that is probably the same as yours. If your bullets fail to kill these highly intelligent and increasingly endangered animals, you could be in real danger. Of course, other animals are to be found in greater numbers. Take pheasants. If anything, there are too many of them, and like most people who don't read The Guardian, I'd happily pick up a 12-bore shotgun to help control population numbers. Stamina training in Ethiopia is certainly an interesting idea, and one that I've come up with without any help. But as someone with a natural flair for geography, capital of Azerbaijan is Baku, I know that combining my Norfolk-based radio show with daily trips to East Africa would be nigh on impossible. Indeed, when I check it out with a local travel agent, I don't even mind that he sniggers at me because, as I say, I already know it's nigh on impossible anyway. No, rather than feel any anger towards this man, my main emotion is one of profound sadness. In my experience, people who laugh at perfectly reasonable questions, inquiries about daily return flights from Norwich to Addis Ababa or otherwise, tend to be deeply insecure. My hunch is that, as a travel agent, he feels threatened by my far superior geography nous. Karachi has a population of 9.3 million. But was he right to pull that face and snort at me? Well, that's not for me to say. Instead, all I can do is report the facts and leave any such moral judgment to you, the listener. And in that spirit, allow me to add a postscript. A few weeks ago, I had a verruca and was in town getting quotes from various chiropodists. I like to place your operatists off against each other because I believe that my feet deserve the best care at the best possible price. I'll get a quote from three of them, then begin the mind games and negotiation that allow me and my feet to achieve a price we're comfortable with. The chiropodists don't like it, but knowing that I could easily opt for an over-the-counter alternative, these days they have little choice but to bend to my will. I should say at this point that I've decided to start referring to the travel agent by his name. My concern is that overusing the word he is going to have a detrimental effect on my prose style, and at the end of the day, that has to take precedence over his right to anonymity. Grady Travel, owned by Elliot Grady, is located roughly halfway between two of Norwich's more price-malleable chiropodists, and as I walked past it that day, I noticed that it was closed for lunch. Alas, the truth was far sadder. Grady's business had been liquidized, the victim of intense competition from the internet. Or so he says. Because while I don't have a dog in this particular fight, it does occur to me that if the internet is really such a big threat to high street travel agents, then we'd all buy our holidays online, which of course we don't. For his own sake, like I say, it doesn't affect me either way, I really hope that one day he can summon up the balls to admit to himself that his business actually failed because of his own haughty attitude towards customers, whether they wanted to fly to Addis Ababa or otherwise. But even if he can't, I'm comforted to think that in his new job as shelf stacker at Asda, Grady has at last found a role that, if he's honest, is better suited to his skills and abilities. And with shoppers asking him the location of everything from self-raising flour to gluten-free burgers, there's even a bit of geography thrown in for good measure. But at a level Grady can actually handle. And while that may sound trivial, it's the kind of knowledge that can bestow a certain dignity on a man, even if he is a shadow of his former self. As for me, I need another plan. How will I get into QSPC? Wallop! A man's body smashes into the water, a billion tiny air bubbles fizzing around it like a nagging ex-wife. Ping! The lids of his eyes pop open, but the balls of his eyeballs, make a shocking discovery. Why the hell is he naked? The pain! Suddenly he's clawing at his peepers. Well, of course he is. There's acid in the water. And stop. Take a breath. And another. One more. Good. What you've just been experiencing is a massive hit of pure adrenaline brought on by a writing style so immediate it was as if I were mainlining the images into your cerebral cortex with a big literary needle. I adopted the style for good reason. Research shows that a lot of my listeners went to polytechnics, which means listening for long periods of time can be incredibly challenging for them. I switched into a powerful high-octane prose style reminiscent of the early work of Lee Child as a way of recapturing their attention. Let's discuss it some more. You'll all have your own ideas as to what the story was about. Who was this mysterious person, and into what had they been plunged? Perhaps she had visions of a burly East European gangster, stripped naked and shoved into an acid bath. Or a captured US serviceman stripped naked and shoved into an acid bath. Or maybe you think he's a bent copper, shoved into an acid bath, also naked. Well, whichever you imagined, you'd be wrong. For a start, the acid bath, the one component common to all your ideas, doesn't even exist. Because while the principal character did believe there was acid in the water, there was no suggestion that he was in a bathtub. No, in actual fact, what I was describing was nothing more sinister than a trip to the local swimming pool. The passage told the story of a man, Alan Partridge or me, diving in and feeling the perfectly innocent sting of chlorine in his/my eyes. An essentially mundane activity has now been seared into your mind's eye all through the power of words. Footnote. The suggestion of nakedness is, I concede, harder to explain. Unlike certain adult-only swimming pools in Germany and Scotland, bathing without trunks is prohibited in England, and I, for one, take great care to ensure I always wear mine. Now, I was using something called artistic license, which is a literary term for lying. For authors such as myself, it can be a real boon, allowing us to make up anything we want and never be challenged on it. Let's carry on. Whoosh! He's swimming now, his body slicing through the water like a sharp dolphin. Swell. The effort of swimming, combined with a healthy diet, is making his muscles develop right here in the pool. Tumble turn. He attempts a tumble turn. Pouf-wah! He emerges from the tumble turn and coughs chlorine-filled water off to the side. Peep! The lifeguard blows his whistle. Hey, stop speeding! He shouts through the whistle. And stop. Breathe. Okay. Good. The tang in the back of your throat, the pounding headache, adrenaline again. Rest a while. It will pass. We could carry on in this vein indefinitely, but it's tiring for you to listen to and exhausting for me to write. The point is, when your publisher tells you to skip the training section because it only works on film and it's boring in prose, it's not hard to make them eat those words and prove once and for all they don't know what they're on about and should maybe pipe down in future. So why am I in a swimming pool? Well, I don't like walking because walking is boring, and I also have two cars. And while I'm well aware that walking will be hard to avoid once I set off on the footsteps of my father walk, that doesn't mean it has to feature in my training. Instead, I've decided to build up stamina by swimming. Swimming is an ancient technique in which the coordinated thrashing of the arms and legs provides propulsion through water. Effectively, the human participant briefly becomes a boat. Well suited to those with large shoulders and feet like spades, swimming enjoyed a boost in popularity in Victorian times when, due to advancements in water husbandry, we were able to domesticate H2O, trapping large amounts of it in four-sided pits, or pools. I myself have been swimming since early childhood, and whilst I wouldn't describe myself as a water baby, the word baby suggests weakness, I've certainly had a life rich in aquatic activity. True, I didn't enter a swimming pool at all between the ages of 6 and 11 because I became scared of an imaginary water monster called Quaddy. But, as I say, other than that, I'm certainly no stranger to the way of the Speedo. Historically, my technique of choice was the backstroke. It's a tricky one to master because you can't really see where you're going. But as a young man, I always had more than enough spatial awareness to avoid any WTAs, water traffic accidents. Of course, as you get older, keeping your bearings becomes increasingly difficult, which is why recently, with incidences of me crashing on the rise, I took the difficult decision to retire the backstroke in favour of its far safer cousin, the breaststroke. Training-wise, my plan is to swim each morning at 6 a.m, although on day 2 I switched to 7 a.m. because I discovered that the leisure centre doesn't open until 7. The key thing is to rack up miles. I estimate that if I can swim for 2 hours each day, it will give me a fighting chance of avoiding the near-certain death that my doctor so clearly implied awaited me on the road. Pretty soon, I settle into a routine. With my alarm set for 5, I hit snooze every 10 minutes until just before 7, at which point it's time to start the day. With no need for a shower, the swim will get me clean, I can be out of the house in minutes. To get me in the right frame of mind, the drive to the leisure centre is soundtracked by a mega super maxi mix of nautical theme tunes, Blue Peter, Das Boot, Howard's Way. Not to mention the music from Jaws. Yes, the image of a great white somehow finding its way into Norwich Leisure Centre's municipal pool and causing pandemonium, and it would be pandemonium, never fails to raise a smile. For breakfast, well, it's all about protein. In the car, I have 2 hard-boiled eggs washed down with a 1-litre protein shake, which I think might also be made from eggs. Footnote. Yes, it is. I checked the label. Ingredients. Eggs, water, whey. Footnote. Incidentally, if you're ever on this kind of diet, remember to eat some roughage. All protein and no fibre makes Alan a blocked boy. Into the changing rooms and the process of getting ready is a cinch, because all I have to do is remove my coat and pyjamas. I don't even put my trunks on. Fearful of forgetting them due to morning grogginess, I always make sure to put them on before I go to bed. It's an elegant solution. I have to confess, the swimming itself is harder. 2 hours is a long time to sustain constant physical activity, and in the first few days, I often find myself asleep in the water. I realise I have to slow my pace. What that means, however, is that I end up being lapped by another early morning swimmer, a pensioner who calls herself Dawn, and indeed is called Dawn. Now, in and of itself, being overtaken by a retired dinner lady isn't a problem. Whereas Dawn is here to keep fit, or as fit as a pensioner can realistically be, I am in training for a challenging endurance event in the footsteps of my father. Of course, her attitude towards me shouldn't matter, but it does, big style. She clearly thinks my slow and steady pace is the fastest I can swim, and although she never says that to me, she doesn't have to. The patronising, "Morning," as she swims past me. The irony-laden, "Enjoy the rest of your swim," as she climbs out to get changed. No, that woman's feelings could not be clearer, and something needs to be done. As I sit in front of the TV, angrily eating crisps, it comes to me. I will challenge her to a race. Yes, the more I think about this idea, the more I like it. And the more I find myself nodding in appreciation. The idea brings to mind duels of days gone by, and also other events from the past where, rather than being team-based, it was just one person against another person. Oh, how sweet my victory will be. I can almost taste it now. Salty. Perhaps even slightly meaty. Although that may just have been the crisps. The race will be 2 lengths of the pool and I will beat her comfortably, ripping her, to use a piece of modern-day parlance that I personally find deeply unpleasant, a new arsehole. Yet the next morning, dawn doesn't show. Nor the next morning, nor the next. With days running out until I have to head off in the footsteps of my father, I begin to lose hope. And then on my final morning in the pool, out of the blue, literally in this case the women's changing rooms had recently been painted aqua, dawn appears. It seems the gods are smiling down on me, perhaps from a large cloud high in the atmosphere, or maybe from up in the swimming pool's viewing gallery, where they can enjoy a cup or two of the sublime chicken-flavoured soup drink dispensed from its vending machine. But back to dawn. "Morning," she calls over as I breaststroke through the water. "Yeah, whatever," I think back at her. "Morning," she says again. "Yes, I heard you the first time," I reply, still inside my head. "I want to race you," I add, but this time outside my head. With the gauntlet laid down, I allow myself to sink away under the water. It's a powerfully dramatic exit. It isn't even a problem that I'm in the shallow end and I'm only a few inches below the surface. I just tuck my knees into my chest and go into the mushroom position until I'm sure she's gone. But there's a problem. While under the water, I begin to play back the incident that has just unfolded. I realize Dawn didn't hear what I said. My words were obscured by a loud splash. In clear contravention of the International Code of Conduct for Swimming Baths, a teenager had entered the pool by performing a bomb. Knowing that action needs to be taken, I quickly and efficiently de-mushroom, my head popping back above the water like some sort of benevolent human kraken. The lifeguard hasn't taken any action against the naughty boy, so, like any right-minded person, I attempt to catch his eye and tut. But my mouth, still sodden from all the swimming I've been doing, is simply too wet. Instead of tuts, the best I can muster is a series of squelching noises that make it sound like I'm eating. Ironically, another act expressly prohibited by the International Code. Worse, when I look back, Dawn has gone, and is heading back into the changing rooms, having forgotten her distinctive yellow nose clip. These clips, perched at the end of a user's nose, force the outside walls of the nostrils flush against the septum, creating a watertight seal. Yet though we understand a great deal about the mechanics of such clips, the reasons why female pensioners insist on wearing them are less well understood. Some have suggested that as women age, an abnormality in the X chromosome means they forget they're not supposed to sniff underwater. Others are more cynical, believing that elderly women wear them because they think that having a deeper, more nasal tone of voice makes them more attractive to lifeguards, many of whom are less than a quarter of their age. Not that any of this is my concern. All I want to do is race the bloody woman. I shall stand outside the changing rooms and wait. 9 minutes later, I'm still waiting. What is she doing in there? It doesn't take 9 minutes to find a nose clip. Certainly not a distinctive yellow one. Besides, hovering by the entrance of the women's changing rooms looks weird, especially for a middle-aged broadcaster in the current climate. I slide back into the pool, creating barely a ripple. Footnote. Of all the disciplines involved in swimming, I'm perhaps most adept at the getting in. I've decided to keep swimming, aware, perhaps even keenly aware, that I still have a few minutes of my daily 2-hour session to complete. Slow and steady, I glide through the water. Yet it's at times like these that I think I'd be quite content to have been born a merman. Or merman, although ideally one furnished with a full set of functioning genitals. But all this daydreaming about being a merman or merman, and about falling in love with a mermaid who looks quite a lot like Daryl Hannah in Splash, only with brown hair, means I failed to notice Dawn. She's back in the pool, nose clip clamped onto her nostrils, and is about to begin her swim. I need to get down to her end, and fast. Clearly this is a moment tailor-made for the front crawl, but I can't do the front crawl, so instead I opt to scull, the swan-like grace of my upper body belying the fact that under the water my legs are going absolutely gangbusters. Within seconds I reach the shallow end, where I allow myself to become beached. I swivel my head dawnwards. "Morning," she says. "That's original," I think. "Having a nice swim?" This woman is unbelievable. It's all I can do not to flick water at her. It's time for me to do some of my own out loud speaking. I fire up my vocal cords. "You and me, it's on." "What's that, love?" But I'm not ready to answer yet. I'm too busy slowly nodding my head while mouthing the words, "It's on, it's on." Dawn swims off down the pool without even responding. Oh, this woman is a real piece of work. No matter. I'll soon rein her in. I stand up, chlorinated water cascading off my glistening body, my giant frame casting a shadow across the majority of the shallow end. Raising my arms above my head, my fingers pointing upwards, my thumbs touching, I execute a textbook standing dive. Within moments, I've caught up with her. "Having a nice swim," I say as I burn past her. "Yes, thank you," she replies, pretending she doesn't realize I'm shoving her own words back down her throat. Within a minute, I've lapped her. God, that was easy. But then, disaster. As she stops to chat to a friend, the nerve of the woman, I get into difficulty in the deep end. In my determination to best dawn, I've forgotten that I've only just finished a grueling 2-hour swim. I'm also dangerously low on calories, having forgotten to drink my egg smoothie that morning. And now, with victory in sight, cramp has struck. With spasms ripping through my muscles and with the lifeguard busy sending a text, I know I am in trouble. I begin to sink. Then a saviour. Hooking an arm around my neck and swimming me ashore, i.e. the side of the pool, is none other than Dawn. To some, this would be the ultimate humiliation. Not only have I failed to finish the race, but I had to be rescued by my geriatric nemesis. Clearly, though, that is the wrong way to look at things, and you'd have to be quite thick to do so. The reality is that by zooming past Dawn and extending that lead to over a length, I have proved myself the superior swimmer, thereby exacting my revenge for 2 weeks of sneering condescension from the narcissistic 70-year-old. Never again will she mock me. Never again will she imagine, even in her wildest dreams, that she could come close to the kind of pace and power of which I am so clearly capable. That said, I would like to thank Dawn for saving my life.